Terminator.
Mother brings me into the world, it will be full of sunshine and overflowing with flowers. I have never seen a flower, you know, but more than anything, I want to see my mommy. How do you look, mommy?
December 24th. I wonder if my mother hears the delicate beat of my heart. Some children are born with sickly hearts, and then the gentle fingers of the doctor performs miracles to make them healthy. But my heart is healthy. It beats so evenly. Tup, 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 tup. You shall have a healthy son, Mother. December 28th. Today, my mother killed me.
Go on, put your hand now, move.
Something is about to bust.
Let the host move.
Something is about to bust.
Come on.
Something is about to bust.
I want you to begin to pray in the Holy Ghost. Come on. Lord, we pray in the Holy Ghost. Does the host excel in strength?
By the way, thanks for your witch's invitation.
I'm Zach. I'm a musician, a former worship leader. I helped destroy Mars Hill Church. And I'm not really sure what I believe anymore, and I'm okay with that.
I'm Dave. I'm a Bible theology nerd, an occasional preacher, a movie buff, and I'm a Christian that is having nightmares. Nightmares about Doug Mastriano winning the governorship in Pennsylvania, or Herschel Walker winning in Georgia. A Christian with nightmares. More specifically, an evangelical with nightmares.
Well, you should do what my parents told me to do when you have nightmares. You just tell the demons to go away in the name of Jesus and go right back to sleep. That should be easy, right? This is Veterans of Culture Wars.
Veterans of Culture Wars is a podcast where we have conversations about evangelical Christianity. We welcome you to the podcast, whether you are a believer or not. And we are recording on October 26th, which is an anniversary for Zach and I, the date that our first podcast show was released 2 years ago, right here around, Jesus Ween, Harvest Festival season, something like that. Right, Zach?
Those are the only terms I'm aware of for this time of year. Yeah.
All Hallows Eve.
There you go.
All right.
Yes. Around here, we celebrate the Harvest Festival and whatever that may mean for you. I don't really carve pumpkins. I never got good at that. We didn't do any of that secular stuff growing up.
Yeah.
yeah. The Harvest Festival has returned. Very, very spooky.
Absolutely. And we have a terrifying episode for this occasion.
More terrifying than what I just played before Hank Kooneman.
I heard some Carmen.
Lil Marky. And then I started it off with one of my favorites, a little piece from the mid-90s musical by Kathy Hill, Go Go Jonah, which I got to act in junior high.
That's some nice history. I've never heard of that one.
It's a very timely Terminator joke, which was a very big hit with kids. And you can look up on YouTube and see people still loving that joke, performing it recently.
Oh, man. Well, for this spooky Harvest Festival episode, who do we have on to celebrate with us, Zach?
We have a very mysterious fellow by the name of Christian Nightmares. You may know him from social media. I usually think of the word content in a really negative way, but that's more like because I hear like like movies and like traditionally things that you think of as like art being referred to as content. But I think Christian Nightmares is okay with embracing the term content for what he does. I don't know. It doesn't really matter either way, but what he does in combing through the basement of evangelical culture and sharing some of the choicest nuggets and increasingly some of the formerly fringe elements that are now dominating the discussions of Christian nationalism and all that. But for anybody who is like deconstructed or is dealing with very strange memories of their childhood growing up in evangelical culture, if you haven't already checked out Christian Nightmares, please, please do. Welcome to the show. Chris or Christian. Well, we may end up going back and forth, but welcome.
Thanks. Yeah, thanks. Thanks a lot for having me. That intro was amazing. Lil Marky was in there.
I'm a long time Lil Marky fan, like 17, 18 years, something like that. Yeah. Going back, I think WFMU's blog posted about him.
Yeah, that's around, right.
And that's how I discovered him. They had that 365 days of like outsider music daily post that they did. And he is incredible. I have played him previously on this show, his cover of Audio Adrenaline's Big House to torment recurring guest Joel Hanghartsey. Sorry, Joel, if you're listening.
We may have permanently scared him away from the podcast.
Yeah, Lil Marky is something. Do you I know you like posting Lil Marky now and then. Yeah. Have you tracked down any of his stuff physically? Do you own any?
I don't own any. And you know, there's not even a ton of videos. Like for people that are listening, like his voice is creepy enough. But if you ever get a chance to see his videos, it just adds a whole other element to
the live video where you see him switching from his normal adult man voice to his Lil Marky voice to do a duet with himself.
Yeah.
Is amazing. I, as a collector of Christmas records, did see that he has a Christmas record on vinyl. And my wife has absolutely banned it. from the house. That is not going to happen, and
she's probably wise.
Yeah,
I would think
that's a good idea. So
yeah, keep that in good condition.
I was going to ask you about your name, Christian Nightmares. Is it more for like you're highlighting, you know, I've seen a lot of your content on Instagram and I follow you on Twitter for a while. Are you highlighting obviously bad experiences with the church in the past, or do you exist to give current Christians nightmares? I'm just trying to gauge how spooked I should be here, or a little bit of both. How did she come up with that name?
I think I was just trying to come up with a name that kind of captured mainly how I felt growing up, you know, like just the nightmarish world of growing up in evangelical Christianity, you know, just being scared all the time and, you know, deep fear of the rapture. And, you know, I just wanted to kind of take a look at this stuff that really freaked me out as a kid and kind of look at it through adult eyes and put it under this under the title of Christian Nightmares. So I guess it's you know, I don't know if I'm think of it as giving Christians nightmares. I think of it as, you know, just labeling something like this is a Christian nightmare. Yeah, it started off as a blog, and I really was just doing it for myself. I had no idea whether anyone was going to react to it, and then people kind of started reacting to it, and it kind of grew from there. But yeah, it's kind of a cathartic exercise, and it's a way for me to talk back and respond to things that kind of traumatized me as a kid. And, you know, and sitting in church, I had to just kind of, you know, sit still and keep my mouth shut. And this allows me to say what I really feel, how I really feel about it when I couldn't for so long.
And it's kind of a mix of old stuff and new stuff. So a lot of the things that, yeah, would have given you nightmares as a kid, but then you're also sharing a lot of these frightening Dominionist, New Apostolic Reformation, Seven Mountains, Trumpian pastors that are declaring that anybody that opposes Trump is a demon and yada, yada, yada. Mm-hmm. Being ensconced in that so much, I wonder if you feel like you have more nightmares now than you did as a kid. Because this stuff is also beyond our control.
Yeah.
Terrifying.
I don't really have nightmares anymore. I mean, I think that, you know, I don't know if I'd recommend it, but I think that doing Christian nightmares and just looking at this stuff over and over and over again, kind of, it helped me a lot. It was almost like electroshock therapy or something. I don't know. It was, I just was just, you know, bombarding myself with it. I think I got to a point where I finally could see, oh my God, this is so absurd. You know, like, how could I be scared? You know, why was I so scared of this stuff at that? I mean, I know why I was at that age, because I was so, you know, indoctrinated. Now it just, it's become even more relevant over the past several years and through the, you know, the Trump as president, that I've just felt the need to respond to it even more. And just, you know, I want to speak, you know, respond to it and speak out against it and create a community where other people can kind of come together and laugh at it at times, or discuss it in a way that hopefully is therapeutic in some ways. Or
now, this is, of course, as we mentioned, Harvest Festival season. Mm-hmm. This is our annual Harvest Festival episode where we get to acknowledge the existence of spookiness. We are not technically in costume, but as Dave said, he is still an evangelical. So that's basically the scariest thing in the world right now. Good job, Dave. we normally start with the show sort of talking about, I guess, experience with evangelicalism in general. And I, you know, growing up, if they went to church, if they went to Christian school, that sort of thing. We are interested in that, but specifically, if you could talk a little about what your experience with the late October season was like. Were you allowed to dress up and go trick or treating and any of that stuff?
Yeah, I was. I mean, my mother was super into the church, and you know, we went to a really fundamentalist Baptist church, very strict. You know, a lot of preaching about hell and, you know, fire and brimstone kind of sermons. But my father was not involved for many years. He became somewhat involved a little later on. But so he, you know, so we could dress up. We couldn't do anything too crazy, you know. It had to be something safe, like a, you know, like a scarecrow or a farmer or something. You know?
I was a farmer like 3 years in a row.
Yeah. Yeah.
The same costume.
Very non-offensive. Yeah. But yeah, my dad was like, no, these kids, they're kids. They're going trick-or-treating. It's Halloween. But so we were able to do that. But then we, of course, had to do stuff at church too. So there was a lot of time, spent at church. And there was like the trunk-or-treat stuff. And the they would have some sort of haunted, it wasn't like a hell house, but it was something similar to that where, you know, you'd kind of walk through something, you know, you'd get scared. And then it always ended with a sermon about, you know, the gist of it was, you know, if you think this is scary, imagine eternity separated from God and burning in flames in hell, you know? So that was a typical Halloween. But for me too, I mean, church was scary all the time.
So yeah.
Not just around Halloween.
Especially, I'm not sure your age, but you know, I'm an 80s baby. And the mm-hmm. Satanic Panic was pretty big for my early years. And
yeah.
I learned about cults in Sunday school at a certain point.
Yeah.
A lot of talk about that. I remember, like, I think it was fifth grade. We had like a month and a half of my Sunday school teacher had this book, The Kingdom of the Cults. And each chapter was like a different cult. And he'd tell us about them and all the scary things that they did. And isn't it great that we're not them? But they could kill you and eat you, you know.
Yeah, we had some of that too. And yeah, it was the Satanic Panic. It was, for me, it was backmasking, mm-hmm. you know, subliminal messages in rock music.
Did you ever watch that documentary, Hell's Bells?
Yeah, I think I did see that a while ago.
Okay.
Yeah.
You saw that in youth group. Yeah, people.
The double VHS.
the filmmakers claiming that, for instance, Led Zeppelin's Stairway to Heaven has a back mask about a praise chorus to Satan or something like that.
Yeah, I forget what the exact line was. Like, here's to my sweet Satan, I think it was.
Something like
there
that, right.
That. Yeah. I thought there was one that's I am Satan's son. I forget. Dave, by the way, was converted as a teenager.
Okay.
So
yeah.
Yeah, so the backmasking talk for you would have been pretty early into it.
Yeah, so I was I became a Christian in 1994 and I was I was converted in a, you know, the Grace Brethren Church, which is a smaller denomination but kind of like Baptist. And so I missed a lot of the satanic panic. Like, I kind of feel like older people would just tell me weird stories about stuff that happened. But we definitely watched Hell's Bells in youth group. That was probably, you know, when I was 15 or 16.
Yeah. Yeah. It was, Satanic Panic and like a lot of hysteria around Dungeons and Dragons.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
I played it a few years ago for the first time. And even then, I felt like, is something going to happen to me? Like, and then I get that. And it's just like nerds riffing.
Yeah.
Like, yeah.
I mean, I don't think anybody that preached about that had any idea what was really going on there. You know, it just got repeated that this was somehow demonic and satanic. And
the thing that I remember hearing the most was that the character that you create is essentially a demon that you invite in. And it's so real that if, you know, kids would commit suicide if their D&D character died. They couldn't handle that break with reality or whatever. They got fully sucked in and couldn't tell the real world from D&D. And like,
exactly. Yeah, there were a lot of urban legends around that. I think one was like a kid was in his car and he just ended up driving into people because he was overtaken by his character. And yeah, tons of stories like that.
Oh, I didn't hear that. You mentioned the rapture is something that scared you as a kid. Hell. I was also very afraid of both. The rapture was a bigger deal, more immediate.
Yeah.
Like if you're a teenager, you know, there was the like, please, I want to have sex before the rapture. that was a pretty big deal to be afraid of when you combine the rapture doctrine with purity culture. Real problems there. How did those fears manifest in your life? Like, were you more scared of like your friends going to hell if you didn't save them, or more scared of like you not being actually fully saved, screwing up and ending up in there, all that sort of stuff?
I think both. I mean, I was really afraid early on. I've said this before, but I wasn't sure if I really believed, but I was too afraid not to believe.
Mm-hmm.
So I was constantly doubting myself. So I was terrified that, you know, if maybe did I really mean it the last time, you know, when I accepted Jesus into my heart? Was I sincere when I said that, or did I have some doubt in there? And, you know, so maybe I'm not really safe. So, you know, I was constantly, I was just kind of really paranoid about it. And constantly just, I had rituals before I went to bed that have kind of carried into my, you know, I'm a little OCD. And, you know, I'd have to do things in kind of a ritualistic way, like turn off the lights and, you know, set things up in my room a certain way. And then I'd have to say the same prayer every night in order to go to sleep. Mm-hmm. And and I was asking Jesus into my heart all the time just in case.
Did you get baptized multiple times?
I didn't get baptized multiple times. I was just, it was more kind of kept it to myself because I also didn't want people to know that I was, you know, doubting at all.
Yeah. I was fascinating seeing these like political rallies, these Christian nationalist MAGA rallies that are now doing baptisms.
Yeah.
I'm like, wow, that has taken the I may as well get baptized again just to make sure to a whole nother level.
Yeah.
I think for our listeners, this is the Michael Flynn, is it Reawaken America tour?
Oh, yeah.
It's almost like MAGA is turning into, you know, like you read about these spiritual awakenings in American history, and now this is the recent one that they're trying to do based on basically MAGA religion, you know, some kind of syncretism with Christianity and Trumpism.
It's been a religion for a while, as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But Christian, back to your story, like I'm assuming this was a teenager, you were starting to have these doubts. And what was the point where, was there a point in your life where you're like, okay, I'm just not a Christian anymore?
I mean, it took a long time. I left home, I went to college, and, you know, I wasn't going to church. I'd come back home, but I kind of have to go to church just to keep the peace. It really took a long time. I don't know if I remember the day where I said, you know what, I'm not a Christian anymore. It just kind of slowly through just life experience, you know, when I finally was able to get out of my small town and get out of the church and you know, went to college in a city and just started meeting more people and just getting out of my little bubble, just, you know, recognizing that the world is pretty big and things aren't as black and white, and meet, you know, met a lot of people with different experiences. And, you know, I was able to live more on my own terms. Didn't, you know, I had a lot of guilt about it for a long time. But I think just slowly over time, I just, it took a lot of therapy too, I will have to say. Was in therapy for years and years. It just kind of slowly happened over time, but I can, you know, firmly say that now that I'm not a Christian. I also think doing Christian Nightmares did help me. It was maybe kind of a radical form of therapy, but something about exploring all of this stuff and looking at it with adult eyes over and over again, really helped me understand both the absurdity of it and the, you know, the kind of the twisted nature of some of these teachings. And yeah, I feel it feels good to not believe in hell anymore and to not be afraid of that. So yeah, long roundabout answer.
Absolutely. I know that you've come as I forget what it's called, the Christian Nightmares Tribulation Band. Did I get that right?
Yeah.
You've done a little cover of I Wish We'd All Been Ready, the Larry Norman classic that was sort of the theme song to the Thief in the Night movies.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, creating a cover of that, using this other context for approaching art that was scary in its original intended context. I know you've mentioned that movie being something that really like messed you up.
Yeah.
I'm wondering, well, you can talk about that movie and all that. But I'm wondering if there is art that meant something to you in reevaluating your beliefs and coming to a different understanding of things. If there's any sort of music, movies, books that was something that was addressing these matters of faith, that was something that you were able to glom onto and that resonated and helped you make that transition out of it.
Yeah, I mean, I'd say for me, it was definitely punk rock and skateboarding culture. I was really into skateboarding and punk rock and just that, everything around that. You know, it was kind of the opposite of what I was raised in. You know, it was more about like living in the moment, and, you know, I really identified with the kind of DIY movement, you know, and like taking action and just bands like the Dead Kennedys and, you know, that really were sardonic and questioning authority and politics and religion in a really strong and funny and kind of fuck you kind of way. I really identified with that stuff.
So you're a pretty like West Coast California skate punk sort of guy. Are you big, like the Minutemen? Is that a big
I love one? The Minutemen. I loved all those guys. And, you know, I like Minor Threat and Black Flag and all of those bands. And I just, you know, love the idea that, you know, I love the whole culture around it too, of just, you know, getting in a van and touring and creating zines and just creating your own community and your whole network. Yeah, that's the stuff that kind of helped me kind of pull away, I think. And just I just related to that stuff so much more than I ever did, you know, Christianity.
Yeah, I always kind of had like one foot in that and one foot in church at the same time, and definitely felt a lot of that dissonance. Well, I was never a skater, but
you know, it's funny you say that, because I was the same way. I was into this stuff, but I had to keep it really hidden. My mother found a bunch of my cassettes at the time, and threw them all out. you know, so I had to keep everything really secret, you know. So I'd listen to that stuff when I could, or at my friends' houses, we'd, you know, listen to that stuff. And then I'd come home and I'd have to, you know, had a whole totally different identity.
You you lucked out that they were the dead Kennedys, not the dead Reagans, or you would have been really in trouble.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
I don't know. They may be onto something here. He was a Democrat.
Yeah.
I listened to an interview with you where you were talking about you do keep your identity mostly hidden, and sometimes for safety reasons, because your social media accounts have gotten pretty big, and there are crazy people, as we have seen out there, that try to do you harm. So that's understandable. But some of your family and friends, like from the Christian world, know where you're at right now. And I listened to an interview where you were talking about that you have some, you know, dialogue and debate with them, and I was wondering, like, what that looks like. What kind of topics do you cover, like, with your family and dialoguing with your friends?
Yeah, I mean, well, not a lot of them do know. I mean, a lot of my friends and family that are still, you know, consider themselves Christian and evangelicals, they know that I don't believe the same way as them anymore, but they don't necessarily know about Christian nightmares. My father knows about it, but that's another story. But my mother doesn't know about it. My brother doesn't know about it. Some of my other Christian friends don't know about it. The conversations we have, I mean, I've kind of stopped having the conversations because it's hard to get anywhere. You know, it always comes down to, well, you've got to just have faith. It's a leap of faith. You know, or that they end up they're trying to get me back into the flock, you know? So it just, you know, I've just found it to be kind of pointless. And we can't talk about politics, you know, like the divisive issues are like they are in the world right now in evangelical Christian world still, of abortion and, you know, women's rights and, you know, gay rights and all of that stuff. So it actually bums me out because, you know, there's family members that I wish I could be closer to that I can never really talk about anything substantial.
I think about that all the time. I've talked about it recently on here. I've heard people say that, like, the core of any, like, solid friendship is openness. And it's already difficult enough to be friends with your parents if you come from an evangelical family, that, especially if it was a Dobsonian dynamic where, like, they're literally taught that, like, being friends with your kid undermines your authority, so don't do anything to be friends with them.
Right.
Just get them to obey you and go to heaven. And so, like, transitioning as an adult to, like, building a friendship with my parents was a very strategic process of, like, I'm gonna start watching football, and I'm gonna, you know, like, I'm gonna cultivate interests that are outside of these other things so that we can have things in common and have a reason to want to hang out just because. And, you know, my dad passed a few years ago, but my mom's still around, and we've been doing the show for 2 years. And she has no idea about it. And I think she thinks I'm still a Christian.
Yeah.
And I've just had to decide that, you know, I use my name when I do it. If she ever Googles her kids, she'll figure it out.
Right.
But I'm not talking about it. I'm not telling her about this. And it's a huge part of my life that is just not something that I discuss. And it really limits, especially if what you're doing is really personally fulfilling. It's like, oh yeah, I had this incredible conversation with this person, or I read this book as research for this or that. And, like, none of that is something that I'm going to end up talking about. And so it's like, yeah, here's what's going on with work.
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
Here's what the kids are learning in school. And it's so limited, but you got to decide, like, what's an appropriate boundary for you and what's okay. Are your parents still together?
They are. Yeah.
Wow. All right. So
my dad goes to church now. There was a point where he don't want to get too sidetracked with it.
No, I'm just thinking about like for him having to keep a secret from his wife.
About me?
They can just like put him in an awkward position or whatever, but it sounds like you've had very distinct relationships with each of them for a long time. So that's not something new.
I do. I have, but I was going to ask you if you don't mind, but like, cause I, you know, it might be, we might have similar experiences. I don't know. But, you know, my father's very protective of my mother. So I think more than anything, he's like, just don't let your mother find out, you know, this would break her heart. You know, So, I mean, what if your mom found out, do you think she'd have a reaction that was, would it be a tough conversation?
It would be a very tough conversation. And, what it would like currently, I don't know how my kids are going to go to college without financial assistance from my family. And if I'm not raising Christian kids, is that going to be off the table? You know,
like
it's partially protecting myself, partially protecting my kids.
Yeah.
I think her finding out about that would be the same as if one of my kids came out to me and I told that to her. I think there would be an equally bad conversation there. I don't want to find out yet.
Yeah.
I'm just not ready for that. And I think, you know, a lot of that probably has to do with having lost my dad, you know, like he's physically not here. I've thought a lot, like, I'm grateful in a sense that he died before going full MAGA and being like the zombified version of himself. I'm glad that like when he died, I still felt like he was the dad I knew. Yeah. I could see this really like putting a huge barrier in our already kind of tenuous relationship.
Yeah.
And that's really scary. So that's, yeah, it's just a bridge I'm going to avoid for now.
Yeah, me too. I'm so conflicted about it though, because in some ways I have a lot of resentment. You know, my mother really forced this stuff on me, and I had a lot of anger about it for years and years. And you know, I think it shaped me in some pretty negative ways that it took me a long time to get over, and I'm still not over it. But at the same time, I don't want to hurt her in that way. And I know that, you know, deep down she thinks that, you know, if she thinks I might be going to hell. You know, and it terrifies her. And do I really want to, you know, I don't want to put her through that. The one thing that she holds on to is like, well, they say once you're saved, you're always saved. So
yeah.
That gives her some comfort, but yeah, I don't want to push it too far.
I think when I really think about it, I think what I'm doing now is consistent with the child that they raised, that evangelical kids learn to keep secrets from their parents.
Yeah.
Letting their parents know that they've sinned or whatever, like I didn't want to get spanked, there was real consequences for being a human that messes up now and then, or isn't messing up at all but like recognizes they have a body or whatever, you know,
it's being human,
all sorts of things, and that kind of parenting creates distrust and teaches kids that it's better to just keep secrets than to have it out in the open. So I think that's kind of what I've continued doing, which is not a great feeling, knowing that I feel like I've deconstructed my faith, but I'm still like in this sense acting in how I did as a kid towards my parents because of this evangelical baggage. It affects everything, doesn't it?
It really does.
It really does. Was spiritual warfare a thing in your family, and speaking in tongues and stuff? Did your mom do that?
We weren't part of that. Yeah. No, like not Pentecostal or charismatic or.
Oh, okay.
But I mean, there was kind of along the lines of like the satanic panic and, you know, backmasking, and, you know, there was the spiritual warfare in the sense of, you know, things like Ouija boards and, you know, letting that stuff into your home. And, you know, that was off limits and, you know, you'd be opening up the gates, you know, to that stuff. So
did you read Frank Peretti books at a too early age?
I didn't.
Oh, okay.
I don't know if I know. Should I?
Oh, This Present Darkness.
No.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it was a massively successful novel that people turned into a like manual for spiritual warfare and took it as essentially like, this is how demons work in the world.
Really? Yeah, I think Frank Peretti is probably safe to say he was the Stephen King of the Christian subculture, but writing about like Satan and demons, piercing the darkness. He had one called Prophet. I read one called The Oath, which had a dragon in it, which actually was kind of fun when I was 14. But yeah, he was, I think, with Christian being an independent fundamentalist Baptist, they sometimes avoided aspects of Christian culture because it was too mm-hmm. worldly, right? Was that your experience, Christian, that some of the Christian music and stuff was even off limits because it was too rocking or the
bad? Yeah, definitely. Yeah. I had other friends that were different denominations that could listen to that stuff, but yeah, they even, yeah, bands like Petra or Striper, or, you know, they thought that was, brushing up too close to what real rock music was about. So,
oh, interesting. So what was your cultural diet as a kid then? What did you experience?
I mean, everything I experienced, I had to kind of sneak off and experience on my own, the stuff that I really enjoyed. Couldn't watch a lot of TV or have to sneak it, you know. There couldn't be TV, movies, nothing.
PBS or sports.
Pretty much. Yeah, and just Christian content, you know.
But a lot of the Christian content
that was approved by the IFB, Independent Fundamentalist Baptist. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
So were you like, you know, listening to Salty tapes and Colby and stuff like that? Was that part of your childhood?
Watched some of that. I think it was even, I mean, a little older than that even. It was like Davy and Goliath, I think, was safe. Uh-huh.
Yeah. I watched a little of that.
I think there was a musician, Keith Green.
Mm-hmm.
Way back. I think he was okay.
Piano player, yeah.
Piano player, yeah. Oh, what's the other guy? He's still around. Michael W. Smith.
Oh yeah, oh yeah.
Yeah, I think that was okay. But yeah, the music. Yeah, it's just boring stuff to me. You know,
it's a lot of what I had growing up.
Wasn't boring to Zach back in the day because he did a Michael W. Smith rap at his Christian school.
Oh yeah, for the really? Fifth grade graduation. Yeah, yeah. Nice. The one song that he raps on Go West, Young Man. Love Crusade. did you ever perform in a Christian play or musical or anything like that?
We did like the Christmas pageant kind of stuff, you know. I might have been a shepherd, you know, here and there, you know. But yeah, that was kind of the extent of it. But we had, you know, it was just so much time at church, and there was just they had what they called after the Sunday service, they had singspirations.
Ooh.
Where it's just a full hour or two of singing, you know. So but it was mostly hymns, you know. But it was, you know, it's the monthly singspiration, and you know, we'd go to that, and I didn't love it, but I didn't hate it, because at least we were singing, you know. At least it was like something physical, and it was a lot more fun than just sitting in a pew being kind of yelled at, you know. So
And did you stick around for, like, were you a youth group kid?
Yeah.
Did you ever, I mean, I guess you do play music because you did the I Wish We'd All Been Ready. Did you ever try to play in the youth group band?
I didn't. I don't know why. I mean, I guess probably because I didn't want to spend any more time there than I had to.
Were you playing in punk bands of your own?
Not till I went to college.
Mm.
Yeah. I really had to. There wasn't much I could do when I was living at my, you know, under my parents' roof.
Yeah, the youth group band thing for me was the low barrier to entry. Like, I get to be in a band and play guitar. You know, we just like, what if we did worship songs with a distortion pedal?
Right.
It's kind of the extent of it. But
was it fun at all?
Yeah. I mean, it's always fun when you get to play with other people. That's just a different dynamic than being home noodling around by yourself or playing along to a Metallica CD or whatever. Mm-hmm. Just playing with other people is just neat. And I don't know. I was even doing that a few years ago, like the last church I went to. And for the most part, I hated all the music we were playing. but
it was an opportunity.
But it was an opportunity to play with other people, and that dynamic is fun. And it made even playing those songs fun. And a lot of it was like they didn't make me play it exactly the way the recording was. I could come up with parts, and so it was a creative outlet that was worthwhile and did something for me.
Was that church Mars Hill?
No, I did play at Mars Hill. And that was like, we wrote our own songs. That was like, we were a band that would practice for several hours, one night a week, even though we were only going to play, you know, once every 2 months or something, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
But like, we took it seriously and we're like writing songs and all that. Like I think Mars Hill like didn't pay into CCLI, the licensing system for contemporary worship that every other church pays into, because all they're going to do is cover existing popular songs. I think having original music was part of Mars Hill's cost cutting.
They had to save the money for Mark Driscoll's books, right?
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. You gotta bulk buy those somehow.
Get it on the New York Times bestseller list.
Exactly.
I have something for both of you guys, actually. Oh, yeah. Hopefully this won't scare you away. This is a tweet that I ran across a few days ago. It's actually posted on 10/22, so just like 4 days ago from when we're recording this. And you know, with our talk, because we've talked a little bit tonight about being able to have good faith conversations where everything is on the table and it's not like a us against them, but it's just kind of, you know, talking about things of life, whether they be faith or deconstruction or politics. So this person posted a tweet about like liberalism and progressivism. Zach and I are both progressive politically, so that's something that we do have in common. I think there's a lot of stuff we line up with there. But this person, Nina Power, who I have not heard of before I saw this tweet, kind of engages in this tweet thread, and I want to read a little bit of her ideas and just kind of see what you guys think of this. But I'll set the table by saying I think this is one of the problems with how Christians view other people. And one of the big ideas in this thread I'm going to read is that if you're a liberal or not a Christian or don't believe in God, you don't have any basis for morality and ethics. I'm going to read a couple of these.
We'd all be murdering rapists if we didn't know Jesus. Right. Argument.
Which reminds me,
I have a heart out in 10 minutes. I got a couple murders I got to do.
This is really the spooky version of Veterans of Culture Wars. So let me just read some of this. So, quote, liberalism struggles with the problem of evil. If everyone gets to pick their idea of the good, and we believe that everyone's desire is positive simply because it's what they want, then we have no basis for telling people that some desires are not, in fact, good. This is why we see institutions like higher education, which should be defending truth, beauty, and justice, encouraging dialogue and defending reality, even when the truth is painful, buckle under the weight of obviously antisocial, sociopathic bullies. Liberalism lacks the resources to stand up to people who seek to impose their desires at all costs and who will infiltrate all large-scale organizations and manipulate the will of good-natured individuals who struggle to imagine that some people have malign intentions. The best way to understand the problem of evil is to understand yourself as a member of a humanity that is riven with ambivalence, the capacity to do good, and the capacity to cause harm. Without God, there is no way of understanding which habits are good and which are bad. The tweet thread goes on. I guess people can look that up if they want to read the rest of it. But there's just, she basically goes on to accuse progressives or people who don't believe in God of being nihilists. So it's like this frame of like, if you don't believe in God, you don't have moral or ethical systems that you abide by, which is not true. It's kind of the, but yeah, just in the spirit of continuing good faith conversations between Christians and non-believers, I know that atheists and non-believers have moral and ethical systems. But how would you guys respond to that?
Yeah, I mean, I something that always, you know, bothered me and still does is this idea that that man is inherently wicked, you know, and this idea that you're born bad, in a way. We just thought that was a terrible way to look at humanity. Especially now that I have, you know, I'm a dad and I have a young daughter, and, you know, I can't imagine, you know, she was having dinner tonight and she threw her dinner on the floor. She's 14 months old, but, you know, I don't think she's bad. You know, I think she doesn't know how to express herself, and she, I don't know. I just, I think that, that's just something that we were taught in church too, that, you know, without God, man is wicked. And they just, kind of like Zach was joking about before, that we just like run wild and do whatever we wanted and rape and kill and pillage. And, you know, I just don't, it's contrary to my experience in life on a daily basis, you know? And it always has been.
I think further, I think that a lot of what she's talking about there, about like liberalism is not structurally equipped to prevent bad actors coming in and messing with things, I think she's kind of right, but doesn't realize how she is right in that her side are the ones coming in and trying, like, getting on school boards despite having their kids even in the public school system, and they're there to tear the whole thing down. And I think a lot of left-leaning folks want to see the good in others and believe that everybody has something to offer. And so I think in a sense we are too permissive of folks that have bad intentions towards others, but it feels like it's the exact opposite outcome of what she is warning against, that liberals aren't going to just destroy the world by getting too liberal. It's that rabid conservatives believe in a zero-sum approach to everything and are willing to take advantage of the empathy and generosity of those on the left to get close enough to get a knife in. And
interesting.
Like, yeah, we'll just see what happens with this election. But
portraying people that disagree with you on theological or philosophical issues of almost being naive, that, you know, people don't know that there might be individuals out there with bad intentions. I think we all know that, you know, right. And we all know that anybody is capable of doing something good or doing something evil. It bothers me when it feels like fellow Christians are not being totally honest about what other people believe or what other people think, and are just trying to frame it in a way of they're naive and they're just letting sociopaths run wild. It's just very, very weird to me to read that tweet.
They put it in spiritual terms all the time. Like their disagreement with somebody is not a disagreement. You know, our battle is not of this world, but against the powers and principalities. And like, I'm not having a theological disagreement with you. I'm being attacked by a demon. And like, you can't have a rational discussion with somebody that takes it to that place every time.
It's a conversation stopper when you're not seeing the person in front of you as a person, as a human being.
Right. And I think a lot it's referred to. It's not like, you know, somebody says, you know, well, I think it's good to murder people. You know, it's, you know, we have laws for that. We, you know, there's collective understanding of what's okay and what's not okay in that sense. It's often, and I think those arguments come up when it's somebody, you know, who identifies a certain way, you know, or it's just, you know, same sex relationship. Somebody wants to marry, you know, their same-sex partner. And, you know, it seems to come up in those arguments, and that's what frustrates me.
I think you're right. I think the subtext of that actually was the LGBTQ community. I don't know if she explicitly said that, but I think as far as, you know, the accusations of sexual anarchy and people run wild, which, I mean, if somebody is a conservative and they state that they believe in rugged individualism and individual rights, you know, on a base level, why would that not apply to gay people or to trans people?
Yeah, I agree.
Because they don't apply things equally. They apply how they want to. That's why all these things are, you know, that's why originalism is a giant fraud. You know, they're not applying that evenly. They're applying it selectively how they want to, you know, whatever. You talked about, you know, you have a young daughter now. I'm a dad. When my kids were little, I was still a Christian, but aware that a lot of the particular charismatic evangelical upbringing that I had was terrifying and not something that I wanted to replicate for them. And so I was already trying to parent pretty different than my evangelical experience. But then I eventually decided that evangelical theology itself causes trauma, causes nightmares. And I'm glad to have taken them out of church while they were still young. How does your work inform your parenting and vice versa, I guess? How does being a dad impact the stuff that you're looking for and posting and sharing and thinking this is an important thing for my audience to be aware of?
Yeah, I mean, I think that I've always been extra sensitive to, you know, clips of young children being indoctrinated, you know, like things like Jesus Camp. You know, I just think that is some of the worst. It's so abusive.
Even as a Christian, that documentary freaked me out.
Or clips. I've shared some clips recently too of little kids that are clearly just kind of reciting what they've been taught or what their parents told them, and you know, and there's, you know, group of adults kind of cheering them on. Isn't that, you know, that's so cute, and looking at how on fire for the Lord this three-year-old is, you know. Clearly has no real understanding of what they're saying. So I think that being a dad now, I'm extra sensitive to that. I've always been sensitive to it, but I'm extra sensitive to that. As for parenting, you know, I have no plans to go to church with our daughter. For me, I want to spend Sundays out. Church and Sundays felt like the opposite of living to me. You know, it was just so to get up and get in, wear something that you weren't comfortable in, and then just sit there and be uncomfortable and be shamed and yelled at, and then go home and eat something. And then in my house, we weren't really allowed to play. It was just this day where you're supposed to be kind of just, you know, honoring God and Sabbathing kind of. Yeah. And then back to church at night. And it just felt so stifling, and, you know, I dreaded it every week. So, you know, I want it to be the complete opposite of that. You know, I want to get out on a Sunday and enjoy the day and take a hike and learn about things together and talk and live. And yeah, that's what I'm planning on. You know, if she is curious about religion or faith, then, you know, we can talk about that too. But yeah, it's not something that I'm going to initiate at all.
Before we started recording, we talked a little bit about our good buddy Mark Driscoll.
Yeah,
he is back in the news a little bit. We've got new information from him, a new revelation from the prophet Mark, letting everybody know.
As he does a Nehemiah series again.
Yeah, back in the Mars Hill days, he preached through Nehemiah when they needed to raise money to open a new location. He talked about how when he was temporarily removed from Mars Hill before he quit, during the time in which we know the elders all intended to bring him back after having him go through a quote-unquote restoration process, he claims that at a Panera Bread, he was told that their real plan is to accuse him of adultery.
At a Panera Bread.
At a Panera Bread.
This is very specific.
Like very detail. Specific. I love the detail of it, and here's why. Mark has a history of bread-based fantasy. Mark would tell us over and over that his biggest dream, his fantasy of not being responsible for all these thousands of people and having this job is, I wish that I could be a bread truck driver, that I could just be driving down the street all day, delivering bread, just smelling that bread all day, just smelling. My workday would just be taken up with the smell of bread. And that's my big dream. And so bread is an important part of his dream life. And I find it interesting that via Panera, bread has worked its way back into his latest fantasy. And it was part of like him saying, you know, I'm not disqualified. Nobody disqualified me. God, you know, God knows I'm qualified, and it's going to be awesome when I meet Jesus because of all the cool shit I've done for him.
But yeah, he was clarifying in the sermon, apparently, that the trap, the famous trap that was set for him that supposedly was revealed to him and his wife at the end of Mars Hill in 2014 is this: they were going to accuse him of adultery and just permanently disqualify him, I guess, as a pastor. I actually just today on October 26th was I posted this. I posted his sermon and kind of, you know, I just said this is false. And Sutton Turner, who was one of the three executive elders at Mars Hill at the time, tweeted back to me and said 100% correct, and the transcripts of those meetings prove that, meaning the meetings, I guess, that Sutton was in on, that they were going to discipline Mark Driscoll. There was no one talking about accusing him of adultery. No one even thought about it. Like, it's not even something that came up. So it's just a continued, like, fabrication that people were out to get him.
Yeah, he needs to be the victim at all times.
Right.
Yeah.
We have some intimate familiarity with good old Mark. He's somebody that you've posted of and about for quite a long time. I don't know if you want to just generally share your thoughts on William Wallace II himself.
I started covering him early on in Christian Nightmares, through Christian Nightmares. Yeah, he's somebody who got under my skin maybe the most. One of the few people who have gotten under my skin the most. Just such a raging, in my opinion, raging narcissist and egomaniac and so condescending and arrogant and, you know, and just, yeah, just a real, just not a nice guy. And you know, he's preaching on everything from, you know, yoga being demonic to, I mean, you could probably talk more about the pussified. What was that?
Yeah, Pussified Nation was the name of his screed that he posted under a fake name back in 2000. So that was that was like 2 months into me starting to go there.
Yeah, he was always and just big on this kind of, he was just this macho, very, you know, homophobic, very. I was not surprised at all that it ended the way it did with him. I just, I was going to say, I'm surprised that he's still going, but I'm not, because that seems to happen a lot in the evangelical world. You know, people get second and third and fourth and fifth and sixth chances. He's a lot more careful now. I still kind of check out his videos from time to time, but he's still saying a lot of stuff that is pretty offensive. You know, he's big on the, you know, gender identity, you know, kick, and, you know, anti-trans kind of comments that he makes. He just can't help himself, so it slips out still.
Yeah, I think that was, you know, part of him moving to Arizona is finding a place where he could be his full conservative political self. Like at Mars Hill, he didn't really get into politics specifically a whole lot.
Yeah.
General gender things, yes. but like, it was a big deal when they did not get involved with an anti-marriage equality rally that came through town. Like other pastors were mad at Mars Hill for not jumping in and being part of that. And you know, he knew his audience at the time. That wasn't going to go over super well with much of the church. I find a lot of why I find William Wallace interesting and what he's doing in Arizona now interesting is that I think he's just gone through a series of reinventions and personas, that the reason that the William Wallace stuff was not a big deal in 2000, but was in 2014 when we reposted it, is we had all this hindsight and this ability to look at that and go, what in 2000 we thought was this silly, performative, over the top Tyler Durden-esque thing is literally what the guy believes. And he just figured out how, in the persona of Pastor Mark, how to present the same ideas in a more palatable, non-fireable sort of way from the pulpit. And then when he got in trouble with that, he was talking about, oh, I'm trying to go on my, you know, like my young, angry, brash young pastor years are over, and I'm really trying to embrace this spiritual father sort of mode that I'm entering into. And that wasn't good enough, and he still ended up having to leave. But then he goes down to Arizona and gets to really play to the conservative crowd down there and be complaining about the woke joke folk. And it doesn't seem to be as effective because he's not standing out there. There's so many other people like him complaining about the same stuff.
Right.
He was more.
Yeah, it's become a lot more crowded.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But he's trying. He's trying real hard to be the shepherd. I guess I wanted to ask you a few things. If you have any like favorite things that you post, I know there's some that you have to repost over. You just love them so much. Hank Kuhneman, Something's About to Bust. I had to put that in for you.
Yeah, thanks.
I'm wondering about this stuff, but I'm also wondering if things like Hank Kuhneman, if they're still as funny to you now as they always were, now that guys like Hank are kind of winning.
Yeah. I mean, when I post that stuff, I don't think it's hilarious, you know? I mean, that song is pretty incredible, but, it's like, you know, it's funny and horrifying, you know? I mean, I'm laughing but also wincing at the fact that these guys are becoming more mainstream and that they do have power now, and that it's just incredible to me that anyone could take somebody like Hank Kuhneman seriously, you know, that you can just, that there's a whole slew of self-proclaimed prophets now.
The self-proclaimed prophet who doesn't have to be right about anything ever.
Yeah. Who's wrong every time.
Like, you know, every time.
Yeah.
It's incredible.
And people keep coming back. I don't know what my, you know, favorite things are to post. I mean, now there's just, I mean, the technology, you know, social media has just overtaken everything. And now with TikTok, I mean, there's just so much of this stuff out there now. And I feel like, I think right now I'm mostly fascinated by people that pretend or seem to be pretending that they're evangelizing, but are really just trying to become popular influencers, you know?
Yeah. The influencer stuff you've been posting is really interesting. I'm not on TikTok. I don't have the bandwidth. For that. I prefer to scroll through things through social media with my phone muted. I don't like when I have to have the volume on at all times. I'll selectively turn it up if something looks worth checking out, you know, but like,
yeah,
TikTok is just not for me. I'm an old man. I'm sorry. But yeah,
same.
How big of a deal, how dominant is Christian influencer culture on TikTok?
It's huge. It's huge. And I just, that's been really fascinating to me. Just this kind of pretending to to be doing the Lord's work, but really you can just see this real hunger for popularity. It's, you know, and building up your following, and it just seems so desperate and sad, and I don't know, it's fascinating, but it's everywhere. And it's you know, it's part of just kind of more like part of just American culture, you know, than it is, you know, just the blending of the two.
Yeah, I was gonna say the quest for fame and celebrity,
yeah,
and money, you know, by just putting yourself out there constantly and doing the whole social media thing. I mean, there's books about how to become an influencer, I think, out there, right? Just using social media and building your platform, and how to tweet or put content on that's going to get reactions, even negative reactions, to build your follower count and people who are interacting with you. And there's it's like a whole cottage industry.
Yeah, no, it's huge. So yeah, that stuff is fascinating. And the Hank Kuhnemans and the, you know, the whole, you know, Kenneth Copeland is somebody it's who's I always end up coming back to. Just the fact that guy is worth at least reportedly like $300 million. And is, to me, is just such an obvious fraud.
Yeah. I have family members that give him money. And
yeah.
and I don't know how much more obvious he could possibly be.
The guy talks about his private jets.
Yeah.
And, you know,
yeah.
They just can't get over this, like, success means God's favor. Like,
yeah.
Like, prosperity theology is brilliant in that way. Yeah. Like,
right.
Give me all your money, and now I have all your money, and that's proof that God's working.
Right. Right. Exactly.
And works in American culture so very well, tragically. There's a lot of Kenneth Copeland little disciples out there running around.
Yeah, it's sad. Predatory. Absolutely. I guess the other person, Stephen Furtick, is somebody else. I just can't.
I know our friend Stephanie Drury is a big fan of
the oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Put fan in quotes.
Stephen Hey Haters Furtick.
Yeah. See, his transition over the years, too, is pretty striking, you know?
Yeah, the size of his neck has grown considerably.
That's what I was talking about, yeah.
Yeah.
But just how it's kind of, it's that blending of like everything's just like it's like a Tony Robbins kind of, it's that kind of just self-help, you know, meets TED Talk, meets just like, you know, just
a
big
few Bible verses here and there. And then,
but with this kind of WWE energy and, you know, just, it's fascinating to me, but he's huge. He's another one of these guys that's really successful now, sadly.
Yeah, it's what, like, growing up, like, when I think of guys doing that beat, it was the Joel Osteens, who is more like milquetoast, inoffensive, bland, but, you know, God wants the best for you, general positivity. And and now it's who can say the most insane clickbaity thing possible. Is what is building their platform, aka their ministry,
right? Sermons are just a series of little bites,
that
are self-contained.
I'm sure that, like, sermons for guys like these aren't designed for impacting people in the pews. It's just like a debate, you know. You need to have certain short phrases that, you know, can be turned into a video that your campaign can use later. I'm sure that's what these sermons are. It's like, all right, here's the part for my staff to cut up and use. Yeah.
Right.
Intentionally written.
Here's the TikTok part.
Exactly.
Yeah. Right.
Came up on your feed sort of recently. You posted a picture of a prop van used in the production of the next season of The Righteous Gemstones.
Yeah.
What did Smut busters. I think I said that's the Hank Kuna van. Things about the bus, I can't see the word bus without thinking of him these days. Thank you. It's your fault.
My pleasure.
I'm wondering if The Righteous Gemstones has been a therapeutic experience for you to watch.
I do like that show. Yeah, it's pretty funny. I Yeah, and with that van, you know, it turned out that I didn't know that was part of the Righteous Gemstones at first, and then people pointed it out. But it's just one of those things where, like, you can't even tell anymore what's real and what's not. You know, that easily could have been a van.
They have some very inside people on the writing staff, clearly. Like, some of the specific jokes that they do, it's like, there's no way that somebody wrote that that wasn't deeply involved with this growing up.
Oh, definitely. Yeah.
I still don't like the type of church that they run. I don't really relate to that sort of East Coast mega church thing. You know, it's real South Carolina, right? Like, you know, the mega churches I grew up in were like business warehouses, you know, like in
right.
Yeah. That sort of a thing. Like it wasn't that gaudy or whatever, but there's definitely a lot going on, especially with the youth ministry things in the show that I can relate to. Kelvin's God Squad. I mean, basically they just did a power team, an extended riff on John Jacobs and the Power Team, who I saw at the Key Arena with my dad. I had their comic book.
Really?
Oh yeah. I had there actually. I don't have a copy of it anymore, but I should send you a picture of it because they're fighting punks.
Oh really?
Yeah. There's a gang called the Clips who put paper clips in their ears.
Oh man.
And it's like white guys with like Liberty spikes and you know green mohawks or whatever.
Wait, did you say you do have this or you don't?
I don't physically have a copy anymore, but I've found you can buy it for pretty cheap. Like there's copies. And I think there were only four issues total. I was not a comic book guy. This is like a thing that my dad got at a conference that, you know, his business would send him to, you know, he sent himself to, he owned the business, you know, but, but he'd come up and be like, maybe you like this sort of thing. But yeah, it's like John Jacobs having to rescue a teenager who has had fallen prey to this gang that they were going to have him join and he'd never be able to get out. You know, I remember at the time, like adjacent to Satanic Panic was like gang ritual stuff, hearing all about like the initiation things that you'd have to go through and you can't get out unless you kill somebody or something. Right. Like there's all these crazy stuff. And this one, it's punks. I'm like, man, punks are generally pretty nice people.
So I got to get a hold of that though.
Yeah. Yeah. I'll send you the info.
Put on your wall back there. Power team.
In the grip of the Clips. The name of the episode. Nice. Oh yeah. And the leader was named Cliphead.
Of course. Yeah. Because they have no idea what somebody would really be named in the world.
Yeah. There's not much, unlike the Righteous Gemstones, this was not written from a place of deep familiarity. Well, Christian, thank you so much for coming on the show. I've enjoyed your stuff for so long. Thank you for recommending George Azar to come on a few months back with his memoir, My Gay Church Days. That was really nice. Oh. And you connected us up for that.
Yeah. Such a nice guy. I'm really glad that worked out. His story is pretty incredible.
Yeah. So. It was really neat. I don't know anybody that for some reason has listened this long and has never seen what he's putting out, please check it out. Not too late at night. you need a buffer before you go to sleep. Or you know, you just need to remember to tell the demons to go away in the name of Jesus. So
yeah.
All right.
Either way.
Christian, do you want to tell people where the big places are on social media that people can find you?
Sure. I mean, mainly these days I'm posting a lot on Instagram. And it's just Christian_nightmares. And I'm on Twitter, which is Christ and Nightmare. It's the handle's weird, but you can find it if you search for Christian Nightmares. And I have a newsletter now that I've been doing, a Substack, which that's been really fun. So if you go to any of my social media channels, there's a link tree and links to all that stuff in there. So
cool. Well, thank you so much. It was a real pleasure. we won't tell anybody that we know all of your secrets, your real identity, everything.
You got it all now.
It's safe. It's safe with us.
Thanks, I appreciate
here
that.
It will be buried under the floorboards of the VCW hall, where nobody will find it ever again.
Never.
All right. Yeah, no, thanks a lot for having me on. It was really great talking with you guys.
Dave?
Yes.
Are you going to sleep all right?
I think so. I don't think I'm going to have any nightmares tonight because Christian was, he was a really nice guy. I liked him.
Yeah. So this is going to be coming out November 1st. Which that is the day that Hulu releases the documentary on the Jerry Falwell scandal.
Oh boy! We're gonna have some competition with this episode. But
I'm assuming you're listening to this might after be interested having watched in the Falwell that. Yeah, thing. Yeah. Once you're done with that, listen to this. But I hope everybody had a good Harvest Festival. Maybe you won a cake. Maybe are your kids' costumes all done?
Yeah. So this will be coming out Tuesday after Halloween. So my daughter was a chicken going around trick or treating, and my son went as a pirate.
Okay.
And they are very excited. They love our neighborhood. There's like one road into where we live, and it's a loop. And so it's perfect just to walk around, and we know so many of the neighbors, and there's a lot of nice people here. So they have a good time. They get lots of candy, and they have a good time.
My oldest is on the verge of not wanting to go anymore.
Oh, no.
Yeah.
How old's your 12?
13.
Okay. Well, that was probably about it for me. I think that was the age. There was an age where I'm like, I don't want to go anymore. I'm just going to sit at home and hand out candy to people that come by.
That you may recall me mentioning that the first time I went, I was either 16 or 17. It was when I was old enough to drive myself to go trick-or-treating. I think he is going to end up going this year because he decided that he would like to dress up as the anarchic goose from Untitled Goose Game, to like mess with other kids as candy or something. I'm not sure. He wants to be an agent of chaos. And my younger son will have gone as No Face from Spirited Away.
Oh wow.
So yeah, that was.
I've not watched Spirited Away with my kids yet, but I've got to do that soon.
Yeah, that's a good one. They love it. So, hopefully they got a lot of a bountiful harvest of candy.
Yes. maybe within reason, so they're not bouncing off the walls over here, because my kids are 8 and 6. So
I just hope they get enough Reese's for me to take some without them noticing.
There you go.
I want. So
let's call it, my wife Michelle calls it the parent tax.
Yep.
And then and then steals your candy. Some of it anyway. But that being said, this has been another episode of Veterans of Culture Wars, the spooky Harvest Fest edition. Thank you so much for listening to us. Leave us a rating or a review wherever you like to get podcasts, as that helps others find our show. You can go to etsy.com/VCW Hall, and you can get some merchandise if you like. Coffee mug, shirts, sweatshirt. That's a way to support the show if you would like to get some merchandise there. We have a Twitter presence at VCWPod. I am at Dave J. Lester. Zach is at Muzak, M-U-Z-A-C-H. You should check out his website, muzak.bandcamp.com. Order his Christmas record now before the holidays. This will come out. It was Halloween yesterday. So get on ordering that Christmas record so you can listen to it in time for the big holiday at the end of the year.
Thanks again for coming on down to VCW. And remember, the podcast is free, but you still need to tithe 10%.
Ooh. Spoon.